I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, what's going on in your house? But it doesn't look like the set of Leave It to Beaver. Writer Rebecca Walker wanted to capture the many new faces of the American family. We'll talk about her provocative collection of essays in a few minutes. But first, we continue our Black History Month series of conversations. Throughout this Black History Month, we've been focusing on new news about Black history, new scholarship that has emerged in recent decades that sheds new light on the story of Black people in America. Today, we want to hear about communists in the civil rights movement. Now, that's a sensitive subject since those working for equality have often been accused of being communists in this country, but some were. And we're joined now by Robin Kelly, author of Hammer and Hoe, Alabama Communists During the Great Depression. It documents how the Communist Party worked to secure racial, economic, and political justice. He's a professor of American Studies and History at the University of Southern California. And this semester, he's the Harmsworth Professor of American History at the University of Oxford. And we welcome you to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle. It's great to be here.
How did you get interested in this topic? And as I mentioned, it is a sensitive topic because there are those for decades who've worked to tamp down the suggestion that anybody in the civil rights movement was attracted to the Communist Party at all.
Exactly. And this is a story that actually predates the civil rights movement as we know it, going back to the 1930s. I became interested in this as a doctoral dissertation back in the mid-80s when I was very active in a lot of social movements in the L.A. area. And I wanted to know how the Communist Party organized African Americans, particularly in places where Black people were the majority. And so at first, my study took me to South Africa, and I was planning to do a comparative study looking at South Africa and the U.S. South. I couldn't get into South Africa in 1986 because of a state of emergency. And so I discovered the second blackest place in the world, and that is Alabama. And there I discovered a very vibrant movement that very few people wrote about. There basically were two stories, one memoir by a man named Hosea Hudson, and then another story in a book called All God's Dangers, which is about an African-American sharecropper.
All God's Dangers, the life of Nate Shaw. I remember that.
Exactly. But his real name was Ned Cobb. Nate Shaw was a pseudonym. And it's a beautiful book that tells his life story, and only a portion of it deals with his membership in the Communist-led Sharecroppers Union, which at one point had about 12,000 members in the Black Belt counties of Alabama.
And were all the members Black?
Well, in Alabama, there was a point when basically all the members except one were all African-American sharecroppers and tenant farmers.
How did the Communist Party get started in Alabama?
In 1928, the Communist position internationally was that African-Americans in the South have the right to self-determination, meaning they have the right to create their own nation in the South. And this is a position that came out of Moscow. It came from other Black communists around the globe. And with that idea in mind, they sent two organizers to Alabama, and they went to Birmingham. And they chose Birmingham because it was probably the most industrialized city in the South. And they went there thinking they would organize white workers, and from white workers, Black workers would follow. But no white workers would come forward. And so the first two organizers was a guy named James Giulio, who was a Sicilian worker who had migrated to Alabama, and another guy named Tom Johnson. And together, they went out looking for white workers, and Black workers came. And Black workers came in fairly large numbers right away, because for them, they had a memory of Reconstruction, a memory of the Civil War. And in that kind of collective memory, they were told that one day the Yankees would come back and finish the fight. Well, when they saw these white communists, they said, oh, good, the Yankees are here. We can't wait to join.
What was the Communist Party's message at that time? And why were these Black folks so attracted to it?
Well, there were three things they focused on. One, because it was during the Great Depression, their primary focus was the unemployed. And so their demands were, we want either work or some kind of support from the government. The second thing was, in 1931, you had the famous Scottsboro case, where nine young Black men were arrested falsely for raping two white women and ended up going to jail. Well, these cases happen all the time where Black men are falsely accused. The difference was that the Communist Party made the Scottsboro issue an international issue. They put it in the newspapers. They spread the word all over the globe in different languages. And these unknown figures suddenly became a kind of cause célèbre. And finally, the third thing was basic civil rights. The right to vote, the right to sit on juries, you know, the right to not be Jim Crowed or segregated. These things certainly drew out black working people.
You know, there were civil rights organizations that had the same agenda, like the NAACP, for example, which was formed in 1909. Was there overlap between traditional civil rights groups that we know today and the Communist Party, or were they very separate?
Initially, when the Communist Party arrived and began organizing black workers, the NAACP in Birmingham and all of Jefferson County was just sort of a shadow of itself. They had 6 dues-paying members. The Communist Party had about 500. And why is that? Because the NAACP at that time, at least locally, was interested in supporting black business and the black elite and the black middle class. They didn't really have a civil rights agenda per se. And when the Scottsboro case opened up, the leader of the NAACP, Walter White, his concern was whether or not these boys did it. Whereas the communists said, look, we know that they're class war prisoners. We know that they're victims. And they made a big case out of it. So pretty soon, the NAACP and the Communist Party began competing for the hearts and minds of the parents of the boys. And national NAACP leaders said, look, whatever you do, don't let the communists win.
At its height, how many members would you say the Communist Party had in Alabama, particularly among African Americans?
Well, there's a couple ways to think about this. One, in terms of actual dues-paying members, they never had more than 600, 700. But then, if you look at all the other auxiliary organizations, the International Labor Defense, which focused on civil rights issues, they had up to 2,000. The Sharecroppers Union had up to 12,000. You had the International Workers Order. You had the League of Young Southerners, you had the Southern Negro Youth Congress. If you add up all these different organizations, it touched the lives easily of 20,000 people.
There's a lot about this period that is not talked about today. For example, the way lynchings actually occurred, you know, as public spectacles and things like that. I mean, a lot of people like to think that these were like isolated incidences when they were not and so forth. But one of the things that I think people do understand is how violently the political white establishment, let's just say it, would fight back against attempts to organize among blacks, to try to put down any sort of stirrings of leadership. So right. How did all these people function in these organizations?
Well, we have to divide the history of the party up into two periods. From 1930 to about 35, they were really underground, you know. After 35, they kind of came above ground and tried to become legitimate. And that's another story. But let's talk about the underground period. On the one hand, they did have public demonstrations, and they did confront the police. Many people were beaten during these demonstrations, including white activists who were communists. But how did they maneuver? What they had to do was basically take advantage of their invisibility as black people to function. I'll give you an example. Whenever they had to put out leaflets, sometimes black women who were communists would pose as laundry workers and carry what appeared to be laundry into the house of a white comrade. But inside those baskets might be paper and a mimeograph machine. And then they make the mimeograph, then they bring the leaflets out. They'd pass those leaflets on to workers who would go to their jobs, and when no one's looking, drop the leaflets on the ground and let the wind blow them everywhere and pretend like they don't know anything about it. In the rural areas, they might put up, you know, little posters and leaflets up in trees late at night when no one would see them. And then, you know, if you compare, say, a place like New York City, where in the period when so many families were being evicted from their apartments because they couldn't pay the rent, what they do in New York is they'd confront the police. They'd put the furniture back in the house. They'd stand up. But in Alabama, they'd do little secret things like, if the water was turned off, communists would figure out a way to turn the water back on. Or if the electricity was turned off, they used jumper cables to run electricity. Or if someone got evicted from their home, the communists as a group would go to the landlord and say, look, you have a choice. You can either put that guy or that family back into their house, or the next day your house may turn into firewood. my favorite story is, you know, one of the big issues for unemployed people is getting relief from social workers. And sometimes it would be impossible just to get your basic flour and lard and whatever. And whenever workers had trouble with social workers, the Communist Party would get penny postcards and write on these penny postcards anonymously, "The workers are watching you," and send them to the social worker to threaten them to basically give the people what they need. And so these are all ways in which they maintain their invisibility, but were very, very present on behalf of the working class.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with historian Robin Kelly for our Black History Month series. We're talking about African Americans and the Communist Party in Alabama. He wrote about it in his book, Hammer and Hoe. How successful do you think the Communist Party was in bringing about change in Alabama, which is the place that you seem to think it was the most effective or widespread or at least the most present in this period? And the reason I'm asking is even now, I mean, Alabama has yet to elect an African-American to a statewide office, for example. One person is running now, Congressman Arthur Davis. But if he's elected, he will be the first, and it's 2010. So how effective do you think the Alabama Communist Party was?
Well, I think it was very effective in some areas. One, even in trade union organizing, some of the most important organizers in steel, in iron, were communists, who after 1935 were some of the lead organizers in trade union organizing, which really made a difference in workers' lives in the 50s and 60s. The other thing is that there were many people who were trained in the Communist Party who went on to become civil rights activists. Asbury Howard, who was a radical trade unionist who went on to play a significant role in Alabama's civil rights movement, and then Rosa Parks. What does Rosa Parks have to do with any of this? Well, some of her first political activities were around the Scottsboro case. You know, she never joined the party, but as a young woman, she and her husband, in fact, attended some of the meetings. Then the other area is just in the rural areas. This may seem like a small thing, but imagine if you're picking cotton at basically 30 cents a day, and you fight and fight, and you can get your wages up to 50 cents or a dollar a day. It took about 5 years and a lot of bloodshed, but they were able to raise the wages as a result. So there may not be huge victories, but I know one thing. The infrastructure that was laid for what becomes the civil rights movement in Alabama was laid in many ways, not entirely, by the Communist Party.
Why do you think this history isn't better known? I mean, these are not the names and the faces that you see on the calendars.
They are not. And part of it has to do with a long history of the Cold War and the fact that we think of communists as these terrible, horrendous people. But more importantly, we think of them as somehow outside of American culture and history. When what I and others who have written on similar areas have argued is that it's very much native and homegrown. I mean, the Communist Party in Alabama, they began their meetings with a prayer. These were Christians. These people believed in Jesus, in redemption, and they believed in armed self-defense, and they believed that Russia would come and save them if anything got to be really bad. It just made perfect sense to those who lived in that period.
What happened to the Communist Party in Alabama? How did it, does it still exist? I guess maybe would be the question. I don't know. Are they still there? Is anybody still around?
They are still around, actually, but not like they were. What happened to them? Two things. After 1935, the party decided to come above ground and build alliances with liberals and others who are not communists but who are against Nazi Germany and Italy and that sort of thing. So what ends up happening is that you can form alliances with liberals in New York. You can't do that in Alabama because white liberals are not that friendly, Southern liberals. And so what they did was they gave up a lot of their militancy. They gave up their industrial base and other things for the sake of building alliance with people who don't want to form an alliance with them. And so they lost interest. And many of the main activists left the South and moved north. Mm-hmm. The other thing that happened was Bull Connor, who was very active in the 30s, becomes like the man in the 40s and 50s. And Bull Connor and his police force waged a war on the Communist Party in the middle 40s. By that time, the main organization was called the Southern Negro Youth Congress, which was not entirely communist, but it was a group of young black men and women who, in fact, prefigured SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And they had their last meeting in Birmingham in 1948 under enormous police repression and violence. And that sort of spelled the end of them. And so by that time, the Communist Party itself, on a national scale, was declining with the Cold War and the Smith Act and other things which led people to go underground or go to jail. So it was part of a national process of snuffing out the Communist Party as a whole.
Hmm. So what would you hope people would take away from all the work that you've done documenting this history?
Well, first, what I really emphasize is the fact that these are ordinary people, most of whom could not read or write, who were able to, on their own, form a very strong and productive movement that saw not just black people's problems, but all people's problems as connected. They saw joblessness and civil rights and the right not to be raped or lynched, self-protection, that all these things are part of one big struggle. And they really did succeed in building an interracial movement. Even if the whites were in the minority, those whites were there with them. And that vision that ordinary people can make change was the legacy they left us.
Historian Robin Kelly is author of Hammer and Hoe, Alabama Communists During the Great Depression. He's professor of American Studies at the University of Southern California, but he joined us from the UK, where he's currently serving as Harmsworth Professor of American History at the University of Oxford. And his latest book is Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original. Thank you so much for contributing to our Black History Month series.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.